Hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns. My guest today, I should be quite honest, it's pretty difficult to describe my guest today. He's a long distance hiker. He works for a charity, or he assists a charity for working with dogs for people with disabilities, empowering them, getting their life back on the road as far as they can. And he once spent the time, he's the only ex-foreign legionnaire I've ever met. And that's only a little bit, but I think we'll enjoy our little chat with my good friend Dermot Cosgrove. Hello, Dermot. How are you?
Good. Good morning, John. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. I'm fine. How on earth did you join the Foreign Legion? I mean, what possessed you to join the Foreign Legion?
Well, if you ask my mum, I ran away from home. I'm not sure she'll ever forgive me for it, but my family, kind of going back generations, were military. Right. I mean, even up to my older brother who left there a couple of years ago, retired after 43 years service. So my brother, grandfather, uncles, great-grandfathers fought or great-great-grandfathers fought in the First World War. So there was a big military tradition in the family, and I grew up around that. So it was kind of second nature. And I suppose as much as being a kid and going, living on David Attenborough videos and TV programs and wanting to be a zoologist when I grew up, the kind of almost natural path was to become a soldier. And in 1988, when I was kind of at that age, I was 19, there was actually a cap on recruitment in the Irish Army because of the amount of unemployment at the time. So that avenue was kind of shut for me. And at the same time, I kind of wanted to kind of go, well, if I'm going to do something, I want to be the best. And kind of the Foreign Legion stood out as being, having this massive reputation and mystique around them as being, one of the toughest fighting forces there was. So I did quite a bit of research, libraries. We didn't have the internet, of course, at the time.
Spent
my time, reading through books in libraries. And then went, right, that's it. I'm going to join the Foreign Legion. Spent a summer working in a carnival to earn money. And then got up one September morning, told my mum I was going back to college because I'd been in college for a year, and headed off and jumped on a ferry, and she heard from me about a month and a half later.
And so what's that like when you join the Foreign? Do you just sort of turn up and say, hello, here I am? I mean, how does that work?
Well, I was even asked recently by a friend of mine who was doing some research for a podcast on the Legion. And he said, the French embassy won't tell you anything, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, at least you've got the internet and you can email them.
I
sent them five letters asking for information on the Legion, and I never heard anything. So I relied solely on library books. And you do basically show up at a recruitment center. You're taken in. They do a preliminary security background check on you to see if you're on the run or a missing person or anything like that. It kind of goes from there.
I see. Many years ago, I actually visited Corsica. That's where the Foreign Legion are based. Is that correct?
Well, that's where the 2nd Parachute Regiment are based.
Ah, okay. I mean, I saw some. I can't remember the town.
In Calvi, the 2nd Rep are based in Calvi.
I mean, there was young guys sort of obviously running and jogging around there, but they looked, every one of them looked like a professional boxer. They were absolutely the fittest looking guys I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, the Legion tends to have one speed and it's not slow when you do everything. And they love to run and march. And the guys in Calvi, they have the huge advantage of being pretty much on the doorstep of the GR20. hiking trail.
Yeah.
And every platoon commander goes there with a mission to break the GR20 record, which the last I heard was that from, because the parachute regiment still has its companies based around specialities. So I second see. Company would be the mountain, would be the mountaineering, mountain warfare company. And I think one of their platoons still holds the record of something like 4 days.
Oh my God. Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. So, and is it true that you change your identity when you join? Is that right? Or is that just a myth?
It's not a myth. It's, they do change the identity of some people. Now, years gone by, it was very much based around guys who were joining who had a criminal background.
That
era is long gone. It's what you'll have now is you'll have guys, first of all, if you're, depending on your nationality, because technically being the Foreign Legion, there isn't supposed to be any French guys in it, but there are quite a lot. Those guys are automatically have their nationality changed. They'll have their identity changed. They'll have their nationality changed from French to being from Monaco or Belgium or Canadian to justify why they're French speakers. If you're a foreigner and you have your name changed, it might be for very, very simple things. It might be because, you know, you're divorced and you haven't paid the child support or something like that.
Yeah.
And they'll change your name.
So it is very much, it does sort of absorb you, and it sounds like there's quite a mystique to it. But presumably, when you got there, you couldn't speak French, or could you?
I had schoolboy French when I got there, which wasn't very good. But you spent 4 months in basic training. And basic training, unlike kind of other armies, they've got a huge focus on actually teaching you French, because there's 144 nationalities in the Legion. You've got guys who arrive who are semi-literate. You've got guys don't use the same alphabet, who might be coming from Eastern Europe and using Cyrillic. You might have the Nepalese guys who use a version of Sanskrit. So you've got a huge amount of nationalities arriving that do not,
even
read write in using our alphabet. So they have to be taught from scratch.
It sounds like just pulling all these disparate people together into some sort of unit is a massive challenge.
It is.
You'd say, well, what's the worst way to set up an army? Well, you bring in loads of different people who don't even know how to talk to each other.
They've pretty well worked out that the harshest kind of environment builds cohesion.
So is it strength and adversity, really, is it, basically?
It is, yeah, it is. It's they push you to your limits. I mean, I thought I was fairly fit when I enlisted. You know, I did a lot of, I used to run every day. I played rugby. Pretty much on a daily basis, I'd get out and run 10Ks, the whole lot. I got to the Legion and it was just, you know, the guys who were already in, the corporals who were training us, it looked like they were on acid at the speed level they were going at.
Wow.
And you know, you'd go, oh, well, we're doing a 10K today. No, you're not. You're doing a 15K. And that would be first thing in the morning. So, you know, it started off, every morning started off with a long distance run. And then during the day, maybe in the afternoon, you might end up doing a 10K with a fully loaded pack. And that's running with the fully loaded pack with all your gear. So
it's pretty, yeah. I mean, from what I saw, it looked a very, very physical life.
Well, it is.
Well, what sort of adventures did you get into in with the Legions? Anything you'd like to tell us about? Or maybe you can't.
Well, there's some stuff I can't tell you about in case my mum ever listens to this.
But, okay, fair enough.
But I suppose I was lucky in a way. I finished my basic training. I finished high enough in basic training to get my choice of regiment.
Oh, so right, okay.
I, I chose to go to the 2nd Infantry Regiment, which was based in the south, in Nîmes in the south of France.
Right.
And I got there in January, got off the bus, and we were all lined up to be given our arrival speech by the regimental commander. And when he finished, they were parceling guys out to the different companies. And the NCO in charge said, right, any volunteers for the support weapons and reconnaissance company? And I went, oh, it sounds like a good idea to volunteer and be eager and the whole lot. So I stuck up my hand and I ended up in a anti-tank reconnaissance platoon.
Oh, right.
So in some respects, it wasn't the best thing because all the guys there had kind of 2.5-3 year service and they needed young guys. So all the crap falls back on you when it's, you know, the daily duties and the whole lot. But I got some great advice when I got there, was to keep my mouth shut and just get on with it, which I did. And kind of 9 months later, I was promoted to private first class, and we began training to go to Chad in Central Africa.
Right, right.
Where there was a kind of a semi-peacekeeping support of the government mission going on, a long-term mission. And I think about 2 weeks before we were due to go to deploy to Chad, there was an emergency that Chadian rebels had crossed the border from Sudan, had made a big incursion over the border. So there was a huge alert went out, and we ended up leaving a couple of weeks early. But I mean, I suppose the interesting thing about training for Chad is the Legion mentality is, we're going to a desert, let's go to the Alps to train.
Right. Okay.
So I spent about 2 weeks marching all over the Alps.
Right.
And you know, working on navigation and stuff like that. And then we ended up going to Chad. I was in Chad for 5 months,
okay.
Which was almost constant border patrolling. We would set out in vehicle columns, you know, in jeeps, and spend a week, 10 days, just driving around in the desert along the border, looking for signs of rebel incursions.
Right, right. So you did get quite a lot of mountain experience from your Legion training, and you know, since then, obviously, you've been north of the Arctic Circle, you've been to Greenland. Did that train that you got prepare you for that sort of expedition?
It did. In basic training in the Legion, the basic training base is in the foothills of the Pyrenees.
Right.
So you spend quite a lot of time in the Pyrenees, which is fantastic. You spend a lot of time outdoors. You spend a lot of time working on navigation and
right, and
marching.
Okay.
So going to Greenland, even though it was, I had a mild panic attack before going out, whether I could do it solo, because I did it on my own.
Yeah, that's pretty tough. Yeah.
And I suppose it was just, once I got started and got into it, it was just like, you know, this is actually just like the old days, except more relaxed.
And there's no one shooting at you, presumably.
There's no one shouting at you.
No one shouting at you. Fair enough. Tell us about the trail that you did then. What was it like?
Well, I was looking. It was a bit funny because I do a lot of bird watching in the area where I am.
Oh, right. Okay. Tell us where you live now, is it, presumably?
I live in the west coast of Ireland.
Right. Sounds like a beautiful place.
Southwest
actually.
Coast on the, yeah. on the Loophead Peninsula.
Right.
And about 5 km from the house is a wildfowl reserve. And we're one of the spots in Ireland where we have a historic flock of Greenland white-fronted geese come in. So,
oh, right. That's amazing. Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. There's only, I suppose 60, 70 years ago, there was thousands of birds coming in, but there's a massive decline in geese. And nowadays we only have about 17, 18.
Right.
So I had been watching them and photographing them and the whole lot, and then passing on details to the Greenland white-fronted geese study in the UK. And I got chatting to the guy who runs their Twitter account, who's Hugh Thomas. And Hugh was, we were chatting away one day, and you know, he brought up Greenland and tagging birds in Greenland. And around the same time, I'd been watching a David Attenborough documentary where it showed geese in Greenland.
Right.
And I was, you know, watching the program and going, wow, this is, you know, that would be a fantastic terrain to go walking over.
Yeah.
So I was, when I was chatting to Hugh, he mentioned hiking. And I went, hey, hiking? tell me more. And he went, look, I've had loads of people ask me about this. And loads of people waste my time about it. But if you're serious, I'll give you a full rundown, full description of the Arctic Circle trail, which is, I think it's one of the most remote trails in the world.
Right. Tell us a bit about the landscape then. What's that like?
Well, I suppose the easiest way to describe it would be a bit like the Scottish Highlands.
Right.
You know, it's even in, I think the week before I got there, it had been -2, -3. The temperatures came up when I arrived. But you walk out of this coastal town and it's picture postcard, wooden houses, reds and blues and the whole lot. A little on the outside of town, you have all these, you've got hundreds of huskies in a big kennel area because they're not allowed to be kept in the town.
Right.
And then you have these fantastic black granite mountains stretching off with snow lying on them and the whole lot. And it's just, it's visually stunning. And your first day you walk up through this, I won't even try and pronounce the name, but you walk up through this, through this pass, and it looks like a real easy hike. You can pretty much see the trail.
Yeah, yeah.
But it just goes on and on and on and on and slowly, slowly rises.
Okay.
But when you're carrying a heavy pack, it does kick you in the guts a little bit, but it's absolutely fantastic. And you get up through this pass and you've still got snow along beside you. You know, you've got these beautiful snow-fed streams that are coming down. And you get through the pass to the far side and you come out through the far side of the pass to this beautiful, huge fjord. You know, blue water, just all this dwarf willow and heather just stretching out all over the place in front of you. And it's absolutely stunning. And then you've got the sound of Great Northern Divers echoing across the fjord. And it's mind-blowing.
And so there's about 8 days, the trek took you about 8 days, is that right? So you had to carry all your food and everything with you for the 8 days?
You carry all your food, there is huts along the way, hunting huts along the way, so you can avail of those. I bought an ultralight tent because I thought, well, you know, I may need it. And I didn't particularly want to stay in huts every time. And I think I used the huts on 3 nights or 4 nights and then slept in my tent on the other 4 nights.
Oh, okay.
But it was, I got kind of mixed weather there. It should have been quite dry, but I got kind of heavy cold mist for a couple of days. But it was fantastic because you have Arctic fox. I think the most mind-blowing experience I had up there was sitting outside one of the huts having my dinner and got buzzed by a seagull.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah, he came, you know, just dropping in right above me because he was actually hunting an Arctic fox that was kind of mooching around the hut.
Okay.
It was absolutely fantastic. It was stunning. So, you know, you have that experience. So it was beautiful.
That sounds like an amazing. And on your trek, did you see anybody else with many people about, or is it pretty much lonely?
I think I saw about 12 people in the whole week.
Right.
You know, I'd see a few people in the morning time as I left my campsite, which was, I picked close to the huts all the time. I'd see a few people in the morning, and then I'd see a few people towards the evening time.
Right.
That was about it. But during the day, you literally saw no one. You were alone in this huge landscape, and it was... Yeah, it was mind blowing. The only thing I regret about it was actually doing it in 8 days. And I do have a plan to go back up there.
Right,
two
right. Was that too? That was too quick. Well, what kind of mileage is we having to do then to cover it in eight days?
Well, it's 160 kilometers. So, you know, you're doing, you know, you divide that up by eight. But, uh-huh. you know, there was a few days where it was trying to 25 kilometers. There was uh-huh. another day where I only had 11 kilometers to do. But, you know, it is tough going.
Yeah, it will be.
But
sure.
to me, it was absolutely worthwhile doing.
Sounds amazing. Well, when you say worthwhile, you weren't just doing it for the hell of it. You were doing it to raise funds for a charity as well, weren't you?
Yes, I was. When I decided I was going to do it, I thought, well, kind of sitting there, I was going, yeah, I'm definitely going to do this. But if I'm going to go up there and enjoy myself, then I might as well try and do some good while I'm doing it. So my sister has always been involved with, or has been involved for about the last 20 odd years with Irish Dogs for the Disabled. And they train and provide dogs, stability dogs, assistance dogs to disabled people. 9 out of 10 of their clients will be children.
Right.
And they're pretty special because a lot of charities that provide dogs to families kind of insist on a certain amount of fundraising. Kind of, you almost pay for your dog a little bit.
I see. I see.
So, you know, you fundraise in order to get the dog, and then you get your dog, and that's it.
Right.
But Irish Dogs for the Disabled provide dogs 100% free of charge. You right. don't have to do anything for them. They also provide a certain amount of kind of aftercare as well, where they check on you, they check on the dog. If you're going away on holidays, they'll take the dog back from you and place it with a family
right.
so that your dog is always looked after.
Okay.
They do a huge amount of training with their clients, with these mm-hmm. kids on working with the dog.
What is it that the dogs do for people then? What do they enable them to do?
Well, some of these people are wheelchair bound.
Right.
And because of having one of these dogs, they're able to live semi-independently. They wouldn't be 100% independent.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, these dogs will, you know, literally open the doors. They'll empty the washing machine for them.
Right.
Some of them will load the washing machine for them, where you only have to press the button and turn it on.
Okay.
They have a very specialized stability dog as well. And they provide they train these stability dogs for kids who would be wheelchair bound, but would have the ability to walk, but with great difficulty.
Right. So the
dogs provide them with the
support people. Is that right? They literally sort of help. They literally allow people, children to actually walk who otherwise wouldn't be able to.
Oh God, yeah. I mean, I ended up watching a lot of the videos that they've made with these kids, the interviews they do with these kids on their Facebook page, and it's absolutely heartbreaking. I mean, you'll hear like one kid just before I left for Greenland was talking about he couldn't get away. He couldn't wait to get his dog so he could throw his wheelchair away. and you're just going, oh my God, I have to do as much as I can. And these kids are tougher than me and anything that I've done. So, you know, it doesn't matter how sore your feet are at the end of the day, you just plow on.
Right.
And between Greenland and I actually went to, I went to Greenland in 2017 and I went to the Pyrenees to the first leg of the GR10 in 2018. So those two walks, I raised 18,000 euros.
18,000 euros? Wow.
18,000.
That's a hell of a lot.
Now, well, you see, one of their dogs actually costs 15,000 euros to train. So they're quite expensive. The charity doesn't receive any government assistance whatsoever. So they have to raise all these funds themselves to train the dogs. And one of the things they actually do is they work with the Irish Prison Service. So the dogs when they're pregnant go to a women's prison. Where an inmate will look after one of these women who's incarcerated, will look after the dog, take care of her, help her with the with birthing the pups, look after the pups in the first couple of days. And then when the dog is ready, when it's going through its training, it actually goes to a men's open prison. And the inmates there have been trained to work with the dogs. So it's they're not just helping, you know, kids who are going to get a stability dog. They're actually helping people, give them a life skill and give them a motivation.
That's amazing. I've never heard of that.
Life is something worthwhile.
But that's brilliant to use people who, I suppose very difficult if you're in prison to contribute to society. But if you can do that, that's a really valuable thing to be able to do. And I'm sure it must help the people who are, as you say, incarcerated.
It does, yeah. I mean, I think it's been shown that it gives them kind of a purpose back in life.
Yeah.
Gives them kind of, you know, rebuilds their self-esteem that they've actually contributed to doing something. So, you know, the charity kind of benefits a huge amount of people right across the board.
Yeah, sounds incredible. Yeah. So have you got further plans now to go back to Greenland or any other expeditions you want to go on?
Well, 2019, I went to Iceland with the idea of doing a 600-kilometer solo from north to south across Iceland.
Right.
And I got about
4 kilometers
in and had actually destroyed my feet.
Yeah. You had the worst looking blisters I've ever seen in my life. Well, they weren't blisters. Yeah, your feet were falling apart.
Yeah, I ended up having to go to hospital in Iceland to get them doctored and get them taken care of. So I was sitting in a campsite absolutely gutted this happening and feeling like a massive failure at what had happened. And I went, and a mate of mine messaged me, a guy that I've worked with over the years, who's also ex-Legion, and he messaged me and he said, well, how are the feet? And I said, you know, they're in bits. And he said, right. He said, when are you going back? And I went, you're the only one that's even said that. And he said, well, I know you, and I know you're not going to quit.
Yeah.
So my plan was to go back this year.
Yeah, of course. No, that kind
and
of part,
back up
yeah.
in June, which got scuppered with,
COVID. Yeah.
So the plan now is to go. I've got to finalize it all kind of in the new year because I work overseas.
Yes.
And my work was kind of massively impacted with, you know, how I rotate to work and all that. So that should all normalize kind of from the new year.
Right.
And I'm hoping to go back to Iceland in June of 2021. And kind of hiking has kind of had the long distance hiking has had kind of a dual purpose for me because being a big bird watcher and loving photographing wildlife, hiking into remote places gives me the advantage of being able to get into places where other photographers, you know, can't.
Yes.
You can't fly in there, you can't drive in there. So I've gotten to see quite a bit that other people wouldn't see. So, and that's all down to long distance hiking. So, you know, the plan is to go back in June, which is the start of the breeding season for quite a lot of birds in Iceland.
And am I right in thinking that the problem that you had, obviously, with your feet disintegrating, but you were pulling a cart, is that right?
Yes, I decided that just to kind of go, well, let's make this as difficult on myself as possible.
okay, fair enough.
Which kind of probably throws back to my masochistic days in the Legion.
Uh-huh.
I decided I was going to do the whole thing solo,
right,
and to be as self-sufficient as possible. So kind of for 4 weeks, 4.5 weeks to haul all my food for the whole time. And because there's one section of it, which is about, I think it's about 3 to 5 days, crosses a desert, volcanic black sand desert, where there is no real drinkable water in the area because of all the glacial silt. So I'd have to carry water. So I was mooching around looking at ideas and I ended up watching a video of Alistair Humphreys and Leon McCarron in the empty quarter of Oman. and pulling a card that they'd made.
So I
started looking at cards, and I found this mad German who makes hiking carts. He actually started making hiking carts for long distance runners. So they're ultra light in a respect.
Yeah, yeah.
Made with kind of sturdy, lightweight materials. And this cart can haul up to about 45 kilos. So 45 kilos of gear strapped to me and pull it along the whole distance.
Yeah, that sounds easy, actually.
And the other advantage with the cart is when I get to sections where I would have to throw a rucksack on my back, the cart actually stays strapped to the rucksack and you can pull the whole lot onto your back.
Oof, okay.
So for the likes of river crossings and stuff
you
can pull the whole lot onto your back and wade across.
Right. Tell me again, when are you going back there to do this?
Planning to go back hopefully in June. Get up there as early as possible in June. Start off from a small fishing village in the northeast called Rauferhofen.
Okay.
And then walk north to south across Iceland and hit the Laugavegur hiking trail towards the end of it. Spend a few days hiking those trails and then finish up in the town of Vik in the very south of the island.
Yeah, that sounds one hell of a challenge. You know, obviously the plan is you're going to be sponsored again for Irish Dogs for the Disabled. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'll be fundraising again for Irish Dogs for the Disabled.
Right.
And just so people are aware as well, everything they donate goes to the charity. I completely self-fund everything I need. I've been really, really lucky with a bit of sponsorship from Firepot Food. The hiking ration makers. John Fisher there has been kind enough to sponsor food for me for my trail. You've got Pure Hydration in the UK, has made an actually special insulated bottle with the Walk for the Dogs logo on it.
Okay.
So if someone goes to their website and buys one of the bottles, then the charity gets 1/3 of the cost of the bottle.
Right. Okay.
So
well,
you end up with a funky, cool insulated bottle for going to the gym or going out into the wilds, and you do some good by buying it at the same time.
I mean, that sounds fantastic, and it sounds like an incredible cause that you're doing this for. Really valuable work. Look, I tell you what I'll do is I'll, on the podcast page, I'll put details of the charity. People can look at that and maybe go along and buy themselves a bottle or maybe donate if they like. And what would really be great would be if you'd come back on the show maybe just before you go. Next year and we can again talk about what you're going to do, what your plans are, and then hopefully when you come back we can find out what happened. Does that sound all right, Dermot?
Yeah, well, that sounds great with me.
Cool. Okay, that sounds great. Okay, well, thanks very much.
Well, just thanks for having me on, and yeah, I suppose I'm compared to your other guests who I would be big fans of, the likes of Chris Townsend, I'm kind of going, why is he having me on?
I think what you're doing is incredible in its own way. I really do. Okay, thanks very much for talking to me, Dermot. I wish you every success with your expedition.
Great, thanks very much, John.
Okay, you take care.
All right, bud.